I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum present. Members, we do have two new members on the committee, and so if you wanted to just quickly introduce yourself and say what district you represent, please do.
Everybody, thanks for the warm welcome. Cal Warwis, Representative Cal Warwis from District 7B, which is the heart of the Iron Range.
And thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I am Representative Krista Knudsen from House District 5A. And thank you for allowing us to join.
Yes, thank you and welcome. And I think you'll find, even though we have a couple weeks, only have a couple weeks left, this is the best committee. So you're lucky to get to join us here. So before we get to our agenda, just a few housekeeping items. Everyone here today must be seated when they are in the hearing room. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need further accommodation, please communicate with the sergeant's staff. Signs aren't permitted in the hearing room or at the testifiers table. Please leave all signs outside. Clapping and other disruptions are not allowed. All the testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit for testimony. Please do adhere to these time limits or we may have to cut you off. Unfortunately, we have a lot of people and we would like to keep the meeting moving. Thank you to our sergeant's office staff who are present for helping maintain decorum in the committee hearing room. We have four bills on the agenda today, and before we get to that, the first order of business is approval of the last meeting's minutes. Representative Curran may have a motion to approve the minutes for March 25th, 2026.
So moved, Chair.
Representative Curran moves approval of the minutes for March 25th, 2026. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevail, and the minutes for March 25th, 2026 are approved. Vice Chair Feist is going to take over the gavel, and I will come up to the testifiers table.
The first bill on the agenda today is House File 1082, Chair Mueller's bill. I will move to lay over House File 1082. Chair Mueller, your bill is before us. You do have a DE4 amendment. Would you like to move the amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like to present it in?
Yes, please, Madam Chair. And if it's okay with the committee, I would like to just move the amendment and then we can talk about the bill.
Sounds good. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The DE4 amendment is adopted. Chair Mueller, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Direct services to victims of crime in Minnesota are provided by a network of community-based organizations and local governments. These services include domestic violence shelters, sexual assault advocates, child abuse centers, general crime victim advocates, and more. They are located throughout the state, and they are in all of our districts. These programs save lives. They help victims and their families develop safety plans, get restraining orders, and access housing and other services that they need. For victims who report their crimes, advocates are with them throughout the legal process. As an example, I just want to tell you about a case I handled as a prosecutor. In that case, the victim was a victim of intimate partner violence, and she was brutally sexually assaulted one night by her partner while her children were sleeping in the next room. She decided to leave him, and she knew she had to do so in a way that wouldn't alert him to the fact that she was leaving. So the next morning, she took her children and told her abuser that they were going to the library, and they left with only the clothes that they were wearing. Instead of the library, she found her way to a shelter. And once she was safely at a space, she was able to report the crime to law enforcement, and her perpetrator was convicted. I don't know that without the safe space that she had to go to, she would have been able to leave that relationship or find safety for herself and her children. There are many stories like this in the letters in your packets. The primary source of funding for these services is through the Federal Victims of Crime Act, also known as VOCA. The funding that comes from VOCA is not based on taxes, but is instead based on criminal fines and related criminal fees and fines. This account has been unstable over multiple administrations for about a decade now, and it's been declining. And even when Minnesota is fully funded through VOCA, the needs for victim services are far greater than the amount we actually receive. Since 2023, the state has been allocating mostly one-time funding to make up for the lost VOCA funds just to hold these programs steady. Last year, together in a bipartisan way, we passed the Minnesota Victims of Crime Account as a special revenue fund to create some additional sources of funding beyond general fund. And that included marriage license fees, criminal prosecutions of corporations and fines, and then fines committed by those who commit violent crime. While the creation of that count is certainly a good start, it doesn't come close to filling the VOCA gap. And this bill fills the VOCA gap for fiscal year 2027 with one-time funding of $12 million, which is what we just inserted with the DE amendment. Again, this amount doesn't meet the full need. It doesn't address rising costs that programs have, and it doesn't account for any additional budget cuts that potentially could come through other sources. $12 million is the bare minimum needed to keep these life-saving programs afloat in Minnesota. I'll note that there is another bill that I introduced last year, House File 3230, that would have a cell phone line fee that could move more victim services funding out of the general fund, again, dedicated source of funding for that, and we had also included funding for armor radios in that. That pretty modest fee could really fund a lot of good things in Minnesota. I noticed Representative Steer had House File 4810 today related to armor radios and would love to try to work together on both that and this Victim Services Fund as a dedicated source of funding. But in the meantime, I implore you to join me in advocating for at least this $12 million one-time funding for these life-saving programs. I have numerous testifiers and letters in your packets from programs, coalitions, law enforcement, and county attorneys. And then we have OJP Director Babine here to answer specific questions you may have as well. And with that, Madam Chair, if could get my testifiers up, that would be great.
Great. Thank you so much, Chair Mueller. We will go in order listed on the public agenda. So Nicole Matthews and Erica Stubb, please make your way to the testifiers table. And then I will also announce who's on deck as we move forward. Please state your name and your title for the record, and you can proceed with your testimony. Nicole, you are first on the list. Thank you.
Thank you. Just on. Bujon Indinoy Maganang, Nicole Matthews Jaganashamung, Manidu Baneshi Koyendago, Migizian Dodame, Gawa Babaganakag in Dunjba. Greetings, relatives. My English name is Nicole Matthews, and my Anishinaabe name means Spirit Bird Woman. I am Eagle Clan, and my family is from the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. And I'm the Chief Executive Officer for the Minnesota Indian Women Sexual Assault Coalition. I want to thank the chair and members of the committee. Our coalition is a statewide tribal coalition in Minnesota, and we are also the National Tribal Sexual Assault Resource Center. I'm here today on behalf of all six of our Minnesota crime victim coalitions, which includes two sexual assault coalitions, my organization, the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, two domestic violence coalitions, Violence Free Minnesota and Mending the Sacred Hoop, one child victim of crime coalition, the Minnesota Children's Alliance, and one general crime coalition, the Minnesota Alliance on Crime. All six of our coalitions are membership-based organizations which serve as go-to resources for statewide coordination, communication, and policy for our issue areas. And all six of our coalitions are in strong support of amending $12 million onto House File 1082 to ensure that our services stay steady funded. Before you hear from our organizations providing direct services to victims, I want to offer some context as to why a $12 million investment is so badly needed right now. Federal funding for crime victim services has only trended downward since 2018. Some efforts have been made to reverse this trend at a federal level, but there is no broad hope that sources we have depended on in the past will soon become available. In fact, there have been no federal notice of funding opportunities released for this fiscal year, which is causing fear and concern as to whether there will be future support for crime victim services at the federal level. The Minnesota legislature has helped our services stay level funded through one-time appropriations. These funds have allowed programs to keep their doors open and the lights on, but we are now facing a critical funding shortfall. Crime victim services have been involved informed by the Office of Justice Programs that there will be a $12 million cut to available funding through the competitive grant process in the next grant cycle if nothing is done by this body. A 20% cut to life-saving services, to advocates who meet survivors in the courtroom, in the hospital room, in the search for housing, in the active crime scene, in the darkest parts of their lives, a 20% cut to advocates who are already making poverty wages. Minnesota has long been a leader in addressing gender-based violence, and I am so very honored to call this state my home. I am grateful to each of you for your work on behalf of all of our communities in Minnesota and for investing in the safety and well-being of crime victims in our great state. Up next, you will hear from several member programs on the life-saving services they provide across our state and how the existence of those services is in jeopardy without additional funding. And in your packets are letters of support from victim service programs and community partners. Chimiguich, thank you again for your leadership.
Thank you so much for your testimony and your important work. After Erica will be Sarah Reynolds on deck. Erica, if you'd like to introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Erica Staub, and I'm the Executive Director of Hope Center from Faribault, Minnesota. We are the sole provider for domestic violence and sexual assault advocacy in Rice County. We are a small but mighty staff of seven, and just this past year, we served over 1,000 clients. While our valued partners each play a role for a brief time with clients, we walk through the entire process and help them on the path to healing. Our services are a critical part of public safety in our rural community. We play an integral role by partnering closely with law enforcement. Just this week, we were called to the emergency room to respond to a sexual assault late at night. Law enforcement was there to do an initial interview. The sexual assault nurse examiner was there to complete the forensic exam. And we walked through the next steps and options with this young woman. We went to her home with law enforcement the next day to help her feel comfortable and know what to expect from the interview. We then accompanied her to the initial hearing and explained the process, and we will be the ones to walk alongside through the whole process. We help her prepare for court and testifying, we'll help her prepare her victim impact statement, and continue to meet with her for as long as she would like after the case is closed. From the beginning to end, we are there. For the past 10 years, we have implemented the blueprint protocol within our community, which helps victims to safety and to hold perpetrators accountable in domestic violence situations. As a part of this work, we work closely with our county attorney's office, law enforcement, and judges to use the lethality assessment protocol to determine which victims are most at risk and which perpetrators are the most lethal. And then we provide the most collective resources to handle these cases. As we all know, it's not only the victims and their families themselves that are at risk. These cases spill out into the community, into our schools, harming bystanders, and very often our first responders. Unfortunately, funding challenges have forced us into tough decisions about how to best prioritize services. Under flat funding for several years, we have already tried to make several cuts and changes to our programming. We've almost eliminated our travel and training. We've delayed hires, sacrificed our prevention and public-facing roles, and the next round will be additional layoffs. We know our partner programs in rural areas have already closed outreach offices. They've reduced staff by several FTE, which also puts a greater burden on all the other programs as people continue to reach out. Just yesterday, we had three calls for housing from people in other communities who are fleeing and had no opportunities within their community, and we did not have the capacity to meet that need. Chair and members, our organization exists to serve survivors. The question before you today is, what are you willing to lose? Without covering the 20% public funding cut to our services, we will lose some of our critical rural services for survivors. Many counties in rural Minnesota have only one advocate for the entire county. For those counties, a 20% cut is not 20% reduction in available services. Rather, it is potentially a 100% reduction in services. Thank you very much for taking my testimony and for serving Minnesota.
Thank you so much. After Sarah, we will have a virtual testifier, Alexander Delgado. Sarah, you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Sarah Reynolds. I am the Executive Director of Child's Place, a children's advocacy center serving six counties in southwest Minnesota. When a child finds the courage to say, "Something happened to me," how we respond matters. There are 13 Children's Advocacy Centers, or CACs, in Minnesota. We are small in number, but we are critical to our public safety system. CACs have transformed how our communities respond to child abuse. Instead of a child being interviewed over and over again by different agencies, we bring the agencies to the child. We coordinate a multidisciplinary team response to abuse. That collaboration not only reduces trauma for a child, it builds stronger cases and leads to better outcomes. Throughout the process, we provide advocacy and support to children and families, ensuring they receive the services they need. We are the bridge that connects it all together. We are the ones sitting with a child in court as they testify against their abuser. We are the ones sitting, we are the late night phone calls from a caregiver who doesn't know what happens next. We are the support for foster parents trying to understand and care for a child who has experienced trauma. And we are there for families when their child's abusive story is being publicly shared across social media. Our CAC provides all of these services as a team of just three across a large geographical area. This funding is not about growth or expansion. It is about maintaining the response that already exists and making sure that when a child speaks up, someone is there to listen and to help. If we do not secure funding, children in our communities lose their safe place. They lose their voice in a system that is already hard to navigate, and our public safety system loses a critical partner. In rural Minnesota, there is no other resource like us, and there's no one to step in if we're gone. I urge you to support this investment in crime victim services so we can continue to serve the children who need us most. Thank you.
And thank you so much. We have a virtual testifier next, and while our virtual testifier is speaking, if the next two testifiers, Molly Sela and Sarah Kern, would like to step up to the, whatever it's called, desk up there, that would be great. I will now turn to our online testifier, Alexander Delgado. You can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Feist and members of the Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee. My name is Alexander Delgado, Policy Director for Esperanza United. Since 1982, Esperanza United has been mobilizing LIONA communities to end domestic and sexual violence through our statewide bilingual hotline, Refugio, and family advocacy and social prevention teams. We're also a federally funded, culturally specific national resource center whose work is grounded in lived experience, cultural knowledge, and the understanding that solutions come from within the communities most impacted. Across Minnesota, culturally specific organizations are strengthening our statewide response to violence. That includes organizations centered on Asian, African, LGBTQ+, and Native survivors, as well as older adults and survivors with disabilities. Together, they help ensure that survivors can turn to services where they feel safe, respected, and understood. And that matters, because culturally specific services save lives. Survivors are more likely to seek help, trust providers, and stay engaged when services reflect their language, community, and experience. They reduce barriers, and they make it possible for survivors to actually access safety. For many survivors, especially immigrant survivors, translation and interpretation services, cultural understanding, and community connections are not extras. They are often the difference between getting help and remaining in danger. Immigrant communities in Minnesota are currently in a crisis. A nationwide survey by the Alliance for Immigrant Survivors, which we co-chair, showed that over 70% of immigrant survivors fear contacting the police or going to court, with 50% ultimately choosing not to. Because of that fear, many immigrant survivors are staying home with abusive partners rather than seeking help, forced to choose between safety and deportation. And abusers exploit this fear as a tool for power and control. The effects of Operation Metro Surge have been severe, and we will continue to see the consequences for months and years to come. Now is not the time to reduce services. Funding challenges have already forced us to lay off one staff member and reduce the hours of six other staff. When funding is cut, organizations cannot remain present in the community, build trust before crisis escalates, or reach survivors early enough to prevent greater harm. Chair and members, we have made fantastic progress in serving LIONA survivors in Minnesota. Please double down on that progress instead of walking it back. When we invest in survivors, we invest in all of us. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Now we will turn to Molly Sela.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. My name is Molly Sela. I am the Community Advocacy
supervisor with 360 Communities. We provide crucial support for survivors of domestic violence, sexual violence, and stalking through our community advocacy and shelter programs in Dakota County. By now, you've heard about many of the great services offered by crime victim service providers and some of the devastating cuts that programs have had to make. 360 Communities is especially familiar with these cuts. In 2023, we had to make the heartbreaking decision to close our Lewis House in Hastings, a shelter that could house up to 21 people. That closure resulted in our capacity to house survivors safely being cut in half. As the only domestic and sexual violence shelter in Dakota County, that difference is monumental. We are often turning survivors away because we don't have the space, and they are faced then with an impossible decision: whether or not to return back to a home where they are at risk of experiencing continuing abuse, physical harm, and possibly death. We have seen multiple intimate partner violence-related homicides over the years in Dakota County and across the state of Minnesota, including the deaths of children, community members, and first responders. Sustained funding for domestic and sexual violence programs is critical to continue providing life-saving services, support survivors, and strengthening prevention efforts to reduce harm and save lives. Amid our concerns, we also have hope for the future. We want to build a new shelter with greater capacity because we know that survivors deserve dignity and a safe place to lay their head at night. We can provide that, but like the rest of this field, we are stretching every single dollar to its breaking point. Please help us continue to create safety and empower survivors in Dakota County and to continue helping our colleagues realize a violence-free Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next will be Sarah, and on deck is Kenosha Alexander. Sarah, you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Sarah Kern, and I am the Executive Director at Hope Coalition. We are a crime victim advocacy center serving survivors of sexual assault, domestic violence, and child abuse in Goodhue and Wabasha counties. In rural communities, our work looks different. Beyond our regular services, we are often tasked with building systems of safety that don't already exist in our community. Many rural communities lack public transportation, and our advocates provide rides to court, medical appointments, and schools. Our offices double as a space for Zoom court and virtual job interviews, something that was happening just this morning. When there is a gap in services, we figure out a way to fill it. For many years, Goodhue County did not have a way to provide sexual assault exams. We worked with partners to build a sexual assault nurse examiner response with a dedicated exam room in our advocacy office. Before that, victims had to drive over an hour, often in crisis, to sit in an emergency room and wait, some forgoing an exam entirely due to the barriers before them. We also facilitate a safe harbor team, making sure that victims of human trafficking are connected to support and recovery resources. That is what rural victim service programs do. We see gaps, we fill them so that survivors don't fall through. But this kind of work is fragile. Due to flat funding, we have already cut 5 advocate positions, nearly 30% of our advocate workforce. There is nothing left to trim. In rural communities, a 20% cut is not a reduction in services. When one advocate covers an entire county, that cut can mean the loss of the program itself. We serve Wabasha County with one advocate for the entire county. When that happens, the gaps don't go away. They shift to law enforcement, hospitals, and communities that are already stretched thin. Victim services are part of public safety. In rural Minnesota, we are often the piece that makes the rest of the system work. I urge you to protect this funding and provide the $12 million needed to prevent a devastating loss of services. Thank you.
Thank you so much. After Kenosha will be Artika Roller. Kenosha Alexander, you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
All right. Kenosha Alexander. Good afternoon, chairs and member of the committee. My name is Kenosha Alexander. I am the executive director of the Sexual Violence Center. We serve Carver, Hennepin, and Scott counties. The Sexual Violence Center provides advocacy and supportive services to victims and survivors of sexual assault ages 12 and older. I'm here today because a cut to funding would not just reduce services, it would likely eliminate them for survivors who have nowhere else to turn. For the Sexual Violence Center, if cuts happen, we will have to close our Savage office and reduce staff. A 2025 national survey of rape crisis centers tells us exactly what is happening right now before any further cuts happen. 60% of the centers across the nation are already reporting increased demand for sexual assault services. 70% report an increase in housing demand. Yet at the same time, 46% report a decrease in funding. 53% report a decrease in staff, and one in three centers already have a waiting list for services. Demand is rising. Resources are collapsing. Minnesota has already lost standalone sexual violence programs. Over the last decade, the number of rape crisis centers providing services have dropped more than 75% due to closure or merging with other crime victim service providers. If we continue underfunding rape crisis centers, we will see the extinction of the seven remaining rape crisis centers in our state, leaving victims and survivors of sexual assault without critical services. This means no crisis line, no advocate at a hospital exam, no one to help victims and survivors through their healing or criminal justice journey. A cut accelerates that. It means more layoffs. It means counseling wait list stretching for 4 months. It means survivors in crisis waiting or giving up. As I come to a close, I want to say every dollar invested in victim services saves multiples in emergency response, prosecution, and long-term public costs. This is a public safety infrastructure. It cannot run on empty. Survivors in Minnesota are counting on you. We ask you to please act before more programs disappear. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. After our next speaker on deck will be Charles Hempeck. Artika Roller, you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Artika Roller. Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Artika Roller. I'm the Executive Director of Cornerstone. Cornerstone is a crime victims service agency based in Bloomington, Minnesota, that has a statewide impact through the Minnesota Day One hotline. For over 22 years, I have been at work in this field of victim services. Many things have changed in those 22 years, but what has remained the same and consistent is our funding has never been in alignment with the demand for services. Our program provides a variety of services and one of the only programs in the state to be a member of all six Crime Victims Coalition. Something that you haven't heard a lot today about is general crime advocacy that's separate from but walks alongside domestic violence and sexual violence advocacy and trafficking work. Cornerstone serves general crime victims by providing confidential, trauma-informed advocacy, crisis support, and safety planning to individuals impacted by violence and exploitation. Services include emotional support, financial assistance, assistance in navigating the legal systems and social service systems, referrals to community resources, and support that prioritizes survivors' choice, their dignity, and their healing. Our Day One hotline is the largest crisis line in the state. It operates 24/7, day and night. People from all over Minnesota who are experiencing abuse, sexual violence, violent crimes, or other general victimization or criminal victimization call us. Day One responds to more than 33,000 crisis calls, text messages, and chats every year. Any loss of local crisis lines would immediately push additional volume onto our already heavily utilized statewide system. Callers are greeted by a calm, compassionate advocate who listens without judgment and prioritizes their immediate needs. The hotline offers a safe, confidential space where callers can be believed, supported, and guided at their own pace. Advocates provide emotional support, practical information, and referrals when requested, ensuring that each caller feels heard, respected, empowered wherever they are seeking crisis support or just simply need someone to talk to and process. Part of what we asked, part of why we were asked to testify today is that we have been told that one of the cost-saving measures that might be implemented in Minnesota due to the budget cut is the removal of the requirement for every crime victim service provider to have a 24-hour crisis line. As the operator of the state's largest crisis line, if smaller local crisis lines are shut down, the impact on our day one system would be immediate and serious. Survivors do not stop reaching out. Their calls are redirected to the few remaining providers, rapidly increasing the demand on their hotlines. Even small spikes in call volumes lead to longer waiting times for victims and survivors and reduce the capacity to respond during life-threatening moments. Local crisis lines are proven an entry point because they are trusted, they are accessible, they're in those communities. When this disappears, survivors will more likely delay seeking help outside of their community. Day one would be expected to absorb higher risk, more complicated, complex calls with additional resources, creating bottlenecks, staff burnout, and weakened survivor outcomes. This is not cost savings to our state or to our community. It's a breakdown in our safety net for victims and survivors. Cornerstone experienced a non-renewal of our federal grant, and this resulted in closing services for us, critical services for our deaf and hard of hearing community. Chair and members, Cornerstone work is much bigger than our crisis line, and like our colleagues, our other services will also be impacted by the funding shortfall. But today we are asking you to keep our funding steady so that every Minnesotan has a place to call when they feel unsafe. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And now our final testifier, Charles Hempeck, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair, and members of what I understand to be the best committee. My name is Charles Hempeck, and I am the Executive Director of Anna Marie's Alliance in St. Cloud. A world free of intimate partner violence. That vision has inspired our work for the past 47 years. Our service area is Benton and Stearns County, and for our emergency shelter is a primary choice for the counties of Mille Lacs, Wright, and Sherburne counties. We provide innovative programming that includes a pet safe home, licensed daycare, supervised visitation and exchange center, and our recently renovated emergency shelter with apartment-style rooms. Our central Minnesota community has been deeply impacted by intimate partner homicide the past 12 months. These five individuals who have died include Janet Verkreis, Crystal Marshall, Fallis Ali, Quentin McKay Hughes, and Hallie Tobler. While our community continues to process these recent losses, the staff at Anna Marie's Alliance carry on our daily work to ensure that survivors achieve safety and security. Recently, a family arrived at our shelter after experiencing domestic violence, including sexual abuse of their four-year-old. Due to that trauma, the four-year-old would hide from people, wore a diaper, and could not regulate his emotions. After working with our child advocates, the child who are trained in developmental repair, the four-year-old child no longer hid in fear, went to the bathroom by himself, and could better manage his emotions. I hope you carry this message back to your fellow members and leadership. Victims of crime are depending on you. As policymakers, you can help ensure victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, and general crime have access to the essential and life-saving services. We hope you've heard the ways that the field is struggling to keep up with demand. We hope you've heard about the traumas our advocates willingly expose themselves to every single day. What are you willing to lose? We hope you aren't willing to lose any of these services. We are incredibly grateful for this hearing and to co-chairs Mahler and Novotny and to every member of this committee for allowing this issue to be put forward. Please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Kim Babine, Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs, is here. I was trying to figure out where you were, but I was told you were here, and now I see you. If people have any questions, if members of the committee have any questions, thank you so much to the service providers and organizations that came here today to share the important work that they do. I wrote down what testifier Artika Roller said about ensuring that everyone is heard, respected, and empowered, and that's just a really beautiful thing to know that we can do for people who are struggling and who are victims. So thank you so much. And I will turn it now to member discussion. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And I just wanted to say thank you, Chair Mueller, not just for today's bill, but for all the work that you have done, not just for the legislature or in the legislature, but for people who are in need of services like this, and putting the spotlight on how great the need is. It's so difficult when topics are hard enough to even talk about, to get advocates out and to really address an issue head on. And I really admire and respect the way that you have brought that to the legislature. And I hope this is something that we can continue with your leadership. Thank you.
Representative Hollins. Representative Hollins, sorry.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Chair Mueller, for bringing this forward. I'm a big supporter of crime victim services, and my mother worked in that area, and so I have a fair amount of knowledge in it, and I have volunteered in those spaces as well. And I thought it was really interesting when I heard this bill was coming up, I was looking into what that investment means, and I found a study from the UK that said for every pound that we invest, because it's from the UK, every pound that's invested in crime victim services, we save over 10 pounds, almost 11 pounds. And so I was wondering if there's any studies like that. I don't know if any of your testifiers know of any studies done like that in the United States, but I'm guessing it's a similar. I'll pause to see if anybody comes up. Mm-hmm.
Chair Mueller. Oh, it looks like someone.
Come on up.
Yep, feel free to come up. And you can just reintroduce yourself for the record, and you can give us our answer.
Hello again, everyone. Erica Staub, Director of Hope Center. And my understanding is that for every dollar invested, it saves at least $6 in other costs. And that includes with law enforcement and other things that people would be responding to. And also the county response, our nonprofits tend to be cheaper in terms of the response cost as well. So if we're not there, then they would not be able to be there as well.
Thank you. And it looks like we have, if you can reintroduce yourself, sure. And thank you. Answer.
Artika Roller. And my understanding, specifically around trafficking, sex trafficking, and the study in University of Minnesota, led by Dr. Lauren Martin, was $1 spent, $34 saved in the system.
Was that in Minnesota specifically?
Specifically Minnesota, mm-hmm. out of the University of Minnesota.
Thank you. Chair Mueller, did you have something to add? Thank you. Anything follow up?
Thank you so much to the testifiers for giving that answer. So, I mean, I think intuitively we know that when people get the services they need, they're better able to function, they go back to work sooner, they're able to contribute and take care of their kids, and it just has this sort of snowball effect that allows people to function in their communities as members of those communities. So I think intuitively we know that, but it's really good to hear that there's been some studies done on that to support it, because I recognize that we're looking at this money, it's a large amount of money, right, and that you all have a huge gap that you need to fill. But I think it's important as we consider this going forward that this is truly an investment in our communities that's saving money in the long term. And we know this scientifically, right? We have studies that are showing this. We also know it intuitively, and we know it's the right thing to do. So thank you for bringing this bill forward. I really appreciate it.
Representative Steer.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two questions built into one.
So how many crime victim service organizations are there across the state of Minnesota? And then how are the funds going to be distributed? Is it equal of part to everyone, like another bill we're going to hear today? Or is this on a grant process through like poverty levels or victims that we see?
Executive Director, or Babine, is that okay if we go to you, Chair Mullen?
Yes,
looks like it. You can introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Kim Babine. I am Executive Director of Office of Justice Programs. And the number of crime victim service organizations that we currently fund is about 175 across the state. We would expect the money that we're talking about here would be used in state fiscal year 2027 grants, and actually those follow the calendar year as well. We would expect with the funding to maintain, with this $12 million, we would be able to maintain stable funding, so we would expect around 175, but not that number exactly, because the way we distribute it is through a competitive process. So right now, actually, just a few days ago, we published the request for proposals for any organization in the state that's currently providing crime victim services to apply, and then we go through a competitive process of community review and staff review. And then we look at those scores as well as geographic distribution, crime data, other factors to make the final decision on who gets funded.
Representative Steer, any follow-up? Oh, I'm so sorry, Chair Miller.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. And I'll say, too, that it is available online if you wanted to look, find the list of past recipients for each year. You can find that. I pulled it up before this hearing again, and it is a mix of both community-based and local governments. A lot of county attorneys' offices get this funding as well for the advocates that they have there.
Representative Steer.
Thank you. Yeah, I just, smaller counties can't afford grant writers where larger counties can afford grant writers. So I just want to make sure that the money is being distributed to the counties that can afford that grant writer that makes it look really nice. Thank you.
Yep. Executive Director Babine.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, that is a really good point and something that we take very seriously, both for smaller counties, smaller cities, and also for smaller nonprofits. There are some that are more resourced, and we work really hard on our application and in our review to correct for that as best we can, to really be looking at the services provided and not how bright and shiny a grant application might be.
Random question, since I'm the chair and I can just ask random questions. Executive Director Babine, do you think that AI is going to help like small government or organizations like submit more effective grant applications?
Chair, members, that is a great question and one that we will be looking at. There definitely is the opportunity. We have, as people have asked that question, as we've begun taking questions on this open competitive period, is just like we all hear, even if you just tune into a little bit of the news, like don't trust it completely. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that it is telling the story. So it could make it easier for some people, especially around the edges, to maybe polish up a narrative. But we want to make sure that's not what we're relying on to kind of even that playing field.
Cool. Thank you. Seeing no other, it looks like Co-Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Chair Mueller, Jeff, know that we made these changes last year with the funding. Could you give the public an update on how the funding from the special revenue accounts are coming?
Chair Mueller.
I couldn't hear that very well. Sorry, I can't see you, so it makes it more difficult.
Said, could you give us a update? I suspect your OJP can help us. Let us know what the funding levels that have come in with these special revenue accounts are and what our shortfall is.
Executive Director Babine.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Vice Chair. Appreciate the question. The last I saw, and I apologize, I didn't get an up-to-the-date, up-to-the-minute accounting of that. We started seeing deposits come into the account from the marriage license fee, and I don't have the exact number. Well, I have a number in my head, but I don't know what the time period was. We didn't know if that was a quarter or 6 months, but it was less than $100,000. But when I saw that, I saw that's close to an FTE. So we'll take anything that we can get, but it is not yet built up significantly, and we don't expect it to, even if that was, again, I don't know if that was quarterly or every 6 months. I don't think it was monthly. So we'll not have $12 million in there by 2027.
Turn about me. Great. Seeing no further member discussion, Chair Mueller, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks to all of the testifiers who were both here and who submitted letters. The stories are really compelling. These really are essential services, and not only are they essential services, they are essential for public safety in Minnesota, and I look forward to further discussions about this and hope we can get this across the finish line this year. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, thank you for the discussion. I renew the motion and lay over House File 1082 as amended.
All right, the next bill is House File 2099, Representative Johnson's bill. I will move to lay over House File 2099. Your bill is before us, and you do have an author's amendment. Representative Johnson, would you like to move the A1 amendment? And if you can, just explain it briefly.
Yes, Chair Mueller, I'd like to move the A1. The A1 just updates the language from funding in 26 and 27 to just start the funding in 27.
All right, any discussion to the A1 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair, members. Also, thank you to Representative Rapinski for being a co-author on this bill. This is a bill we did hear last session, but it does deserve a little more continued discussion. House File 2099 invests in public safety, ensuring every county, tribal nation, and city of the first class has dedicated emergency management funding. This comes at a time when there's discussions at the federal level to eliminate FEMA entirely, as well as a lot of the different programs that go with it, and place more of those responsibilities on already strained state and local governments. We've already been seeing some instability around different federal grants and training opportunities that had been available for emergency management, which has caused some of this shakeup. Emergency managers are quietly the backbone of disaster preparedness and response, while first responders such as police, firefighters, EMS often receive much of the attention during the actual crisis. It's emergency managers that are setting them up for success, but also helping put the pieces back together after a major incident like that. Despite the critical role they play, emergency managers operate without dedicated state funding. Many counties, especially in rural parts of the state, with limited tax bases are facing the difficult reality of potentially needing to eliminate or severely scale back their programs or positions. Without emergency managers in place, our ability to prepare for, respond to, and recover from these disasters will be at risk. House File 2099 provides stable, dedicated funding that will address this urgent need. The bill appropriates $12 million in fiscal year 27 from the general fund to the Commissioner of Public Safety to support emergency management departments in planning, preparedness activities, and capital purchases. This investment will help local emergency managers carry out those critical activities such as planning, training, infrastructure improvements, and addressing these emerging threats. With that, I'll pass it off to my two testifiers to share a little bit more.
All right. Welcome to the committee. I have Josh Brinkman up first. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Josh Brinkman with St. Louis County Sheriff's Office, Division of Emergency Management. Since I started this job, there hasn't been a year that we have not had a disaster in our county. And that's the same thing with many counties throughout this state. Last year, recently, we had our wildfires. And our staff of two in our division helped with those three wildfires that were simultaneous, helping evacuate people, keep them safe, and then help the recovery process for all those who had lost their homes and every possession that they owned. Back in 2024, we had floods, as did many places across the state. We had cities flooded out, and many of our rural jurisdictions flooded. It was very easy for us to go door to door in a city like Cook to figure out who had damage, who had impacts to their property, who needed a place to stay for the night, for the week, for the rest of the year. What's difficult, though, is who lives down those rural roads? Who don't we know about? Who might be just making it by day to day and not calling 911 for help? That comes the role of an emergency manager, to figure out who are we missing? What resources do we need to connect to those people that we are missing so they are not forgotten? Back in 2024, we did send a mass notification message countywide with a simple survey. And to my right, Dave Anderson was one of the responses to those surveys. As we watched through our emergency operations center, those surveys come through, we said 6 feet of rise in the time frame that he described didn't seem right for that specific location of geography. We weren't tracking any flooding there. With the work of emergency management staff and emergency managers from adjacent counties, because again, I will reiterate, St. Louis County, we are fortunate to have two emergency managers for over 7,000 square miles. Fortunate. That is not the case in many jurisdictions across the state. Once finding out about situations like Dave's, that's where we need to connect the resources that are already out there, but our residents might not know about them. I want to pass it off to Dave with his personal story.
Dave Anderson.
Yeah, welcome to the committee. Go ahead and introduce yourself and begin.
I'm a resident of St. Louis County, and I live in a remote, I've got a mile driveway. And I live on the Colquay River and Indian Lake. And the water came up, I couldn't believe this. And we had one time at a flood, and we had it was a 500-year high water mark. Well, the water was like 12 feet above that high water mark, and I lost basically everything. And when that happens, that disaster happens, you just stand there stunned, and you don't know what to do. I had no idea that St. Louis County had a disaster management. I didn't know where to turn. You think FEMA, because you see that on television. Well, FEMA was busy, and we didn't get a decision out of them for like 10 weeks. And down the driveway comes my friend here, and that's the face of salvation for me. Told me what to do, who to apply for, where to go. Said that the county would take care of all the debris if we brought it to the dump, and we could do that. And that saved me thousands, just that alone. Because everything's gone, all your furniture's gone, the televisions, the appliances, junk. So I'm very grateful. And that's why I'm here today, because I can't tell you how grateful I am. He saved me. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. It does sound like a horrific experience, and I'm glad you could be here today to share what happened to you and that you had someone there to help you. Thank you. All right, we did not have anyone from the public sign up to testify, so we can move now to member discussion, and I have Representative Rapinski on the list. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for bringing this bill forward. I think everybody in this group can agree that supporting local government units for emergency management preparedness is important, and also appreciates the fact that $12 million is a real big bite right now. Additionally, the equal division of the funds between 87 counties, the tribes, and the four large cities could bring some disparity, and I just wish as this moves along that can be considered in how things should be distributed. Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Steer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I was just going to piggyback on that. So, I mean, the way that this bill is crafted prior to the bill that we had before, all the funds would be equally distributed to everywhere. So Hennepin County would get $122,000, and St. Louis County, Coochaching County would get $122,000, where maybe Hennepin doesn't need that funding, and Coochaching County needs $300,000 for whatever they need. So I think if we look at the emergency management centers across the state, some need more funding than others. So I just hope that we do look at that and we move forward.
Thanks. Representative Johnson, did you want to respond?
Yeah, happy to respond. Thank you, Chair. Yeah, we can definitely have those conversations. I mean, with some of those higher population centers, there's going to be higher needs and other things like that come with it, more training requirements, that kind of stuff. Like, for example, Duluth is a city of the first class. We don't have a dedicated emergency manager. It's a role the fire chief takes on. So they are, the chief of one of the largest departments in the state, as well as the emergency manager for the city. So with some of those big, even some of those bigger areas. And, you know, here St. Louis County has two folks in that staff. So there's different, I'm happy to have those conversations, but our goal is to try and get enough money out the door so that every county at least got the start to try and get a stronger, more robust program in place.
All right, anything else? Representative, or Co-Chair Novotny. All right, any closing remarks, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Chair, members. The reality is Minnesotans expect their communities to be prepared when disaster strikes. We always count on our first responders, and emergency managers are part of that first response. So whether it's wildfires, pandemics, civil unrest, or floods, this funding will help all the communities across the state rise up and meet those needs. So thank you all very much.
All right, thank you. And I will move to lay over House File, or sorry, I renew the motion and lay over House File 2099 as amended. Thanks again for being here today. Next up, we have Representative Frazier's bill, House File 2742. I will move to lay over House File 2742. And Chair Frazier, welcome back to the committee. There are no amendments filed on your bill, so when you're ready, please tell us about it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, House File 2742 is rooted in something we don't see often enough in this space, real consensus around a real problem. This bill was developed by the Minnesota Justice Research Center in collaboration with the Center of the American Experiment. When those two organizations come together, it tells you this effort is about outcomes, not ideology. And the problem is clear. Across Minnesota, clearance rates for violent crime are too low. In 2024, only 47% of violent crimes were solved. For aggravated assault, the category that includes non-fatal shootings, the statewide clearance rate is just 56%. And in Minneapolis, only 23% of non-fatal shootings were solved. That means the majority of these serious crimes are going unsolved, leaving victims without justice, communities without answers, and perpetrators free to reoffend. But we also know what works. Solving crimes is one of the most effective ways to prevent future violence. Research shows that smart investments in investigations can deliver a double dividend, reducing both crime and incarceration. And we've seen it in practice. In Denver, clearance rates for gun assaults jumped from 39 to 65% in just 7 months after creating a dedicated unit. In St. Paul, prioritizing non-fatal shootings raised clearance rates from 37% to 71% in a single year. House File 2742 builds on that success. It creates a grant program through the Department of Public Safety to support dedicated teams of police, prosecutors, and crime analysts working together from the moment a shooting is reported. That coordination helps secure scenes, preserve evidence, and increase the likelihood of solving cases. The bill targets resources where they're needed most, requires collaboration across agencies, and builds in accountability so we can measure results. Members, this is also about equity. When crimes go unsolved, it disproportionately impacts communities of color and low-income neighborhoods, regardless of the jurisdiction. Improving clearance rates is not just smart public safety, it's a matter of fairness. And there is clear alignment here. The Senate companion includes a $3.5 million appropriation, reflecting bipartisan recognition that this is a smart investment. At a time when public safety debates can divide us, this bill brings us together around a simple idea. Safer communities start with solving crimes. I respectfully ask for everyone's support of this bill. I believe we do have a couple of testifiers.
All right, yeah, thank you. We have County Attorney John Choi and then Chief Deputy Sheriff Dave Metal-Salem, if you both want to come forward, and then Chief Henry is here as well on deck, so if all three of you want to come forward, that's great. And County Attorney Choi, you're on the list first, so please introduce yourself for the record.
Great, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Choi, and I serve as the Ramsey County Attorney. And first of all, I want to thank Representative Cedric Frazier for bringing forward this bill and his remarks, because I think he's so spot on. And also I want to thank this legislature, especially the members here that were here in 2023. If you might recall, this legislature, Governor Walz, made a massive investment in public safety, $300 million that was spread out across the state. And the county got, our share was about $6.7 million. The city got their share was about $13.7 million. And the story that we're going to tell with Chief Henry and Sheriff Fletcher and David Suzalem here is that in Ramsey County, St. Paul, we're all pulling in the same direction. And that allocation brought us together. And it allowed us to focus our resources on this issue about solving non-fatal shootings. Across this country, by the way, the number, the solve rate is very low. And Representative Fraser talked about that. And I think one of the most important things, and studies will tell you, that the most important thing that we can do for deterrence is actually solving crimes, catching suspects. That is one of the most critical things that we need to be thinking about. And looking at clearance rates across the board, and certainly in the area of violent crime, that is really, really critical. And so on the non-fatal shooting clearance rate, we all came together and we came up with a strategic way to allocate those dollars. So in the county, some of that money went to the suburban cities for overtime, also for training as well. And then we used the money for something that's novel across the country. We're trying to do a victim witness services fund. And then this bill actually allows for that to happen. And so we have helped 18 families. And we're going to evaluate whether or not this theory of change is that if we can just meet the basic safety needs of those who are maybe a part of retaliatory violence, whether or not that could actually make a difference in their participation in the investigation and prosecution. Because oftentimes what happens with these non-fatal shootings is that the victim doesn't participate. And it's because of retaliatory violence, fear for safety. And so our hope is that we, this bill will pass, more of these resources will be available for the entire state. And the University of Pennsylvania is also evaluating this work. But oftentimes, the Sheriff's Office and the St. Paul Police Department get asked to speak around the country about the great work that's been happening. So I just wanted to be here to give my enthusiastic support for this bill, and many thanks to the partners that are here in coming together and pulling in the same direction. And when we do that, we can actually accomplish a lot for public safety. So thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. David Matuslam, Chief Deputy of the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. Chair, committee members, thank you for having us here today. I just want to say John Choi is a little modest. There's County Attorney Choi. He's the one that was really put together this collaboration, and he and his prosecutors have been the glue in this effort. But this concept has worked very well, worked far better than I think we would have thought. And really the proof it could be found in the numbers. From 2024 to 2025, we saw a significant reduction in homicides in Ramsey County of about 36%. So this concept works, and we're really in the early phases of it. So I think this is going to continue to expand and become more successful as we go, as long as we have the proper funding and resources in place. So really, in summary, to not take too much of your time, this really is about saving lives. It's about, you know, getting justice for victims, and it's about increasing public safety in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, Chief, and begin.
Thank you for having me, Chair and members. My name is Axel Henry. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of St. Paul. I just want to plug into some real numbers into some of these things. Everyone has already spoken so well, and thank you so much for bringing this forward. Just to put this in context, in 2022, the City of St. Paul had 193 people that were shot with non-fatal gunfire. Those are not accidental shootings. Those are not suicide attempts. Those are people that were targeted to be shot and or killed. And that number has dropped to last year, 62% down to 73 people. So put that in context. That's 120 individuals in our city that were not struck by gunfire in comparison. That's 120 never happens. In St. Paul, we really pride ourselves on that. The gold medals that we're striving for are the prevention medals, the never happens. The silvers are intervention. How do we take something at a lower level and prevent it becoming a big thing? And then the bronze is that enforcement. We get a lot of enforcement done, and it does have a lot of results, but it is changing the way that we are operating here in St. Paul. It is one of the non-fatal shootings is one of the top levers to drop our homicide rate. The county, you heard the numbers the county's experienced. St. Paul, we dropped our homicide rate last year by 50%, 5-0. Our clearance rate for those homicides, National average is at 51%. It has peaked at times in this country nationally at 62%. Our homicide clearance rate last year was 100%. We are driving these numbers down. We can only do it with your help, support, and resources. Every law enforcement agency in the state right now is suffering with a lack of people, so we have to hire some of that stuff back with resources, and that's money. And we can fix these problems. We can drive down these numbers. We can make them better. Our shots fired calls in St. Paul are down by 55%. And by the way, those clearance numbers, 71% of our non-fatal shootings, which is higher than Denver's, who inspired us, there are still 7 cases left in that stack that we're investigating. I would expect that number to be at 80% for 2025 at the end of this year, because those cases don't go away at the end of the year. We don't leave them back in the year that they happened. It works. The resources, if you give them to us, it works. And again, we are having a whole bunch of never ever happens, which is the real gold medal for us. I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony as well. And I just want to say the numbers speak for themselves. They're really important. And the number of lives that are saved as a result of and injuries prevented as a result of this work is important. You know, the last bill we talked about, for every dollar spent, how many dollars are saved downstream? And it's unfortunate that when we do our fiscal notes, we don't take that into consideration, because I could imagine that this program as well, for every dollar spent for your clearance rates, you're saving a lot of money downstream. I don't know if there are any studies on that. I don't know if they're looking into that. Chair Frazier.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I haven't seen any studies to that effect, but what I can say, these numbers are lives that are being saved. And I think that above anything, I want to focus on that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Great. All right, member discussion. Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing this bill and highlighting the program. Thank you to law enforcement. It is, we're listening to our law enforcement partners, and you're working together and are able to obviously solve these crimes, have great numbers. Chief Axel, my question to you would be, obviously there is the enforcement part, there's the prevention part, but how much is this success tied to your county attorney willingness to hold the criminals accountable?
Chief.
Thank you so much for the question. It's all interlinked. That I think County Attorney Choi said it perfectly when he said we're all pulling the rope in the same direction. In fact, he came to our department to ask us to join on to this at the same time that we were looking at this implementation. And literally the conversation we had was, our timing couldn't be better. We have to work in concert with one another. That happens here in Ramsey County. And as we all know, the folks that are committing crimes, especially crimes of violence, are nomadic. They don't care about what the border is. They don't care if we're going to other cities. And so it's really important that at the county level and even at the state level, we work very, very well together. And that happens here in St. Paul. And we're trying to be a model for that around the state and around the country, for that matter.
Representative Woody.
Yeah, thank you, Chief. And County Attorney, for showing us that model that can be very successful. So impressive numbers. Thank you.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing this forward. Less of a question and more of just a statement of pride. You know, I think Chief Henry took my words away, because I always like to brag about how good St. Paul does in closing our homicide cases. We are record-setting, very impressive, and I think that's really, you know, seeing how everybody works together between, you know, the sheriff and the police department and the county attorneys is very important to getting the job done. And I just want to say, go St. Paul. We're better than everybody. So thank you.
Representative Steer, we're not going to do this for every county and city, just so everybody knows.
I was going to piggyback off of that and say St. Paul PD is awesome, yes. My question is 2.8, 2.9, it's with high rates of unsolved non-fatal shootings and inadequate staffing to investigate these crimes, would St. Paul qualify for this funding?
Representative Frazier.
I think as their numbers go down, they may not. But, you know, I think we can talk about that. I don't want to punish people because they're doing really well.
Representative Steer.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out, what agency are we targeting with this? I mean, is there multiple across the metro area? I know there's probably none of us in greater Minnesota would qualify for this funding.
is it just one particular department that we're trying to focus on, or is there multiple?
Representative Frazier.
I'm looking at anywhere that we have percentage-wise high numbers of cases not being cleared, that would be this focus that I would have for this legislation. So even if you don't have, say if it's a smaller county, smaller number of individuals, you look at violent crimes, non-fatal shootings, if you have a proportion-wise, a high percentage, I would say we'd be focusing on that to help them get those clearance rates up.
Anything else? Okay. Co-Chair Novotny.
Thank you. Following up on what Representative Steer was saying, and I'm probably going to be looking at the representative from OJP, if she would like to step up, but I'll ask the question as she's walking up. Maybe you have the answers from the panel, Representative Frazier. So how much of this money has been, you know, distributed? And Representative Steer kind of touched on it, but I mean, how many departments received this money, and how much are these average grants going for?
Who wants to take that?
Well, sorry, could you repeat the question, Chair Novotny? Sorry.
How many and how much?
Chair Novotny, this program does not exist yet. This would be a new program. What has been used in the past, as County Attorney Choi spoke to and the law enforcement officials spoke to, was the resources that we gave from the public safety grants that we put, public safety aid that we passed in 2023.
Okay, so out of that money, how much money was given to this specific program, and is there any tracking of the results?
Yeah.
And go ahead.
County Attorney Choi, would you want to?
Go ahead, County Attorney Choi. And just for the record, that was $300 million. I think it was tied to the tax bill for public safety aid for local communities to spend however they wanted it. So many of our departments got it and spent it in a variety of ways. So County Attorney
right,
Choi.
Right, Madam Chair and Representative Novotny, that is absolutely correct. It was a one-time appropriation. So Ramsey County in that formula, it was a formula for cities and counties. I think cities got 70% of the money, if I'm not mistaken, and counties got a lesser portion. So with our allocation, it was, I think Ramsey County got about $6 million. We used $1.7 million of that allocation for the Ramsey County non-fatal shooting fund. And so a big portion of that money, about 800,000 of the 1.7, was used for the victim witness emergency fund. And that has served thus far about 18 victims. And I think it's still early to tell whether or not that's making a difference, but we hope that it will. And then I think the remainder of the money, I don't know the allocations, but it was used for training, overtime for suburban agencies. I think there's something else that I'm missing. And then St. Paul got $13 million. And Chief Henry could speak to what portion of that was used for the non-fatal shooting fund. But I just want to also call out Chief Henry, because I think the hard part in all of this is the temptation would be to use this money for overtime and maybe supplement homicide investigators. And we were warned not to do that when we visited Denver. But it's really hard, I think, for a chief to like figure out how to create a standalone unit. And with those resources, Chief Henry figured out a way to do that. And I think that's a big part of the difference here.
Chief Henry.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So yeah, the city of St. Paul got a much larger number. Approximately $3 million was allocated from the mayor to us for a three-year process. So 24, 25, and 26. We are not overspending that money, so we've actually come in just slightly below that. We haven't had to find other sources, and as the county attorney said, we stood up a standalone unit, but we were able to do that because of the funding and be able to basically, the department didn't have extra bodies, we weren't allocated, our sworn staff wasn't increased, so what we did was we had to fill those pockets by taking individuals from different units to do this, but we found the most success in being able to do a standalone unit, and the departments around the country that have come and talked to us have seen that, and they really do believe that that's probably the best approach if you can do it.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. I'm not seeing any other questions. I'll let you close, Representative Frazier.
No, I think I'll end with what I stated in my opening, is that it's rare that we have a consensus on a solution to a problem, and this is that consensus that we have on a solution to a problem, and we can see right here at home that it's working really well. So looking forward to support on this.
Thank you, and thanks to the testifiers and, again, those who wrote letters in our packets. Representative Frazier is going to stay put because next we have House File 4177. I will move to lay over House File 4177. I don't see any amendments, so please tell us about this bill, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 4177 is about trust, accountability, and making sure we do things the right way. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the BCA, is Minnesota's state-level investigative agency. When cases demand independence and credibility, that's where we turn. In 2020, a working group led by Commissioner John Harrington and Attorney General Keith Ellison recommended creating an independent unit to investigate officer-involved deaths. Then came the murder of George Floyd, and this legislature acted on a strong bipartisan basis to create the Force Investigations Unit, or FIU. That matters. This was never a partisan idea. It was about ensuring that when the most serious use of force occurs, the public can trust that the investigation is independent and grounded in facts. The FIU's role was straightforward. It serves as a neutral fact finder. It gathers evidence, interviews witnesses, reviews body camera footage, and builds a complete record, so prosecutors can make decisions based on facts, not pressure or politics. Since then, the workload has grown. The FIU now also handles cases involving criminal sexual conduct by officers and members of the National Guard, and in practice, serious non-fatal use of force causes as well. But capacity hasn't kept pace. House File 4177 is a targeted investment to fix that. It provides $550,000 in fiscal year 27 to add two special agents and one criminal intelligence analyst dedicated to FIU cases, building on the existing base so that the unit can meet its responsibilities. Because independence without capacity is just a promise we can't keep. This bill does not expand FIU's authority. It simply ensures that the team we created can do the job we already asked it to do, thoroughly, timely, and credibly. At the end of the day, this is about public confidence. Families deserve answers, communities deserve transparency, and officers deserve a fair, independent review. House File 4177 helps us deliver on that promise. And with that, Madam Chair, I will stand for any questions.
All right, and I don't see that anybody signed up to testify, so we can move to member discussion. Representative Steer.
Yeah, Madam Chair, may I call up BCA Superintendent Scott Mueller for a few questions?
Yes, he is here to answer questions. So go ahead and ask your question while he made it quickly up there.
Sorry. So my question is this one of the BCA priorities? Was this BCA ask for this funding? Do we need to build up the use of force investigations unit?
And Deputy Superintendent, if you can introduce yourself for the record before you answer that question, please.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott Mueller, Deputy Superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. To answer your question, Representative, this was not one of our initiatives. Our staffing levels for our FIU unit have been adequate for average years. This has not been an average year for the BCA. The number of conflict cases, the number of sex assault investigations, and then also the number of use of deadly force cases involved with Operation Metro Surge have really taxed our unit.
Representative Steer.
So, I mean, could you see this funding being used somewhere else in the BCA, like the new behavioral threat assessment team that was just stood up? I mean, could this funding be used for something else since it's not needed in what Representative Frazier is asking for?
$550,000, Representative, Madam Chair, could be used in a lot of places at the BCA. We would take any and all support from this legislature.
I just hope Rep. Frazier heard that and fixed the bill.
Yeah, Representative Steer.
If I could just respond to that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah,
thank you, Representative Steer, for that question and the comment. I did hear the Deputy Superintendent say that this has not been a usual year, and even though they've had adequate staff in the past, they do not now because of what's happening. That is what this bill is responsive to.
And I'll just add, too, and I don't know, Deputy Superintendent, if you can answer this question. I know in conversations I've had with the superintendent in the past, you know, this unit covers more than just use of force investigations. It's also sexual assaults. It's some National Guard sexual assaults. And I know, speaking, like I said, with the superintendent before, that the numbers, especially the sexual assault investigations, that the projections in the fiscal note were kind of underestimated based on the amount of time a lot of those cases take. And so I don't know if you can speak to that, what you're finding specifically with those sexual assault cases.
Sure, Madam Chair, representatives. For the last somewhere between 20 and 40 years, our use of deadly force numbers in Minnesota, by and large, almost every single year, have remained the same. 16 to 24, almost like clockwork. There's 2 years that went outside of that 16 to 24. One was went up to 28, and 1 year it went up to 29, both in the last 5 years. What has changed is our sex assault investigations involving law enforcement, sex assault investigations involving the National Guard, and very specifically our conflict investigations. Conflict investigations can be anything from investigations involving public officials, allegations of misconduct, but what we're seeing a lot of from local agency requests is us to investigate lower levels of use of deadly force, whether it's, or I should say all use of force, where somebody's seriously injured. So think of a car crash after a chase, somebody's injured. Many agencies are calling us to come in and investigate those, A, to ensure that either force was used or was not used in correlation to those injuries. The other thing that we've seen in the last number of years is our cases themselves have dramatically grown. From 2016 until now, 2016, an average entire case file was somewhere around 3 to 3.5 gigabytes in size. There were about 30 to 40 written reports, and average use of deadly force or conflict case right now is somewhere between 2 and 400 reports, and somewhere between 1 terabyte to 3 terabytes in size. They have dramatically grown. The advent of body cameras, mainstreaming body cameras, mainstreaming other kinds of video surveillance, ring doorbells and Blink, and all the things that we all have and our residents have made these cases grow dramatically.
All right, thank you. Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Deputy Mueller, for your comments in that. Obviously, in the past, I've run budgets, and then I always try to keep the budget pretty tight to the area that there is. There's times when overtime's up because we have a lot of call-outs, other things. They peak, they go down. It depends on the crime. Then you got other areas where you're trying to keep your budget pretty balanced. What I just heard, though, was we got to trust you at the BCA on what you need. It's not just a budgetary thing. You would let us know that if that was down the road, but the work you're doing right now, you haven't asked for this money.
Yeah, and I'll just note, too, that we definitely do have the governor's budget coming. You know, they have, I know they have their own process for what's requested and what comes in through the budget. And so, I mean, obviously we'll see what those priorities are. That bill probably will be here next week. But go ahead and answer that question if you can, Deputy Superintendent.
Madam Chair, representatives, I concur with what you said. We have a lot of different things going on at the BCA. There's needs in all different sections at the BCA to include the Force Investigative Unit.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess to the questions from my colleagues and considering this bill, we know that the governor's budget, the final decisions include a lot of different factors, and I'm certainly aware of situations where agencies identify needs. And maybe, Deputy Superintendent, I want to be careful about how I ask you this. I don't want to put you in a difficult position, but have you ever had something you proposed in the governor's budget process that you felt was needed and that decisions were made higher up than you, that was not something that was going to be advanced in a governor's budget that particular year? Does that happen?
Deputy Superintendent.
Madam Chair, representatives, I appreciate you not putting me on the spot.
Yep.
Having said that, I sometimes have very lofty requests.
Yep.
To ensure that we can provide public safety to all of our partners across Minnesota. That isn't always coincide with initiatives from other entities.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I guess maybe just a request, because what you've described includes a significant spike in work, especially this year, with a budget that's remained flat. I can imagine plenty of reasons the governor would put together a budget that might include a request or not include a request. As you say, there's a lot to consider. I guess I would find it useful, maybe in follow-up to this, if it's okay with the bill's author, to just get a little more information from you about some of those statistics. It sure sounds like what we'll look at is seeing that there is quite a spike as the budgets remain flat, and so this is a response to that. Obviously, members, we have to consider a lot of different things as we're assessing our budget, but I don't know that it's quite right to if in fact that's the case, I don't know we can characterize it as the funding's not needed. There may be funding needed elsewhere. We have to make a lot of decisions, but it sure sounds like it is in fact needed. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you.
Any response, Deputy Superintendent?
Madam Chair, representatives, I do not.
Okay. Nothing from Chair Novotny? All right, closing remarks, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for the questions and for the comments. Deputy, thank you for being here. I think this is something that we've heard clear from the testimony that there has been a spike in these particular cases and the way the cases have been grown, and the resources would be needed to make sure they can keep up. I think that's important for public safety. I think it's always important when we can, in some cases, be proactive to get out in front of things and make sure we're doing as much as possible to keep our community safe.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Deputy Superintendent, for being here today. I renew the motion and lay over House File 4177. Members, that concludes today's agenda, and this meeting is adjourned.